Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And, you know, one of our few returning guests, Mr. Brian Thomas Schmidt, who is currently the editor and co-author of the Predator If It Bleeds anthology, which is out now. Mr. Brian Thomas Schmidt, you may remember, he's been here before. He was one of the editors for, I don't know if a book you ever heard of this, called The Martian. He has been nominated for what? Hugo, am I correct on that, sir?
Yes.
So kind of a pretty big deal. Hugo nominated editor and author, and he's here. We're going to talk a bit about If It Bleeds, which is awesome. It's just this great collection of stories set within the Predator universe, and it's kind of a little tie-in. There's going to be a Predator movie coming out from Shane Black, and I am thrilled to be one of the authors on here. And let's dive right into this. So, Brian, you've made a bit of a name yourself for one of these people, an editor who puts together these anthologies working with some big properties. How did that happen?
Wait, hold on. I've made a name?
Brian.
No.
Other Brian.
Oh, yes, God. Brian. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. It took me a second because I thought for sure you were sending something over to
that
me.
That was awesome. Brian, you intercepted Brian, that question.
Brian Brushwood, editor of science fiction anthologies.
Sorry, working on the Brian, Martian. You host a series on YouTube. How did that start?
It's fine.
You clearly don't need me. I'll just sit back here.
Not.
I was talking to a small press guy online about anthologies, and I had talked to my mentor, Mike Resnick, who did a lot of anthologies, and I had a couple ideas, and they needed a new one in a series called Full Throttle Space Tales, so I ended up doing an anthology called Space Battle. So that was my first foray into it. And I liked it so much that I did a couple Kickstarter anthologies and then ended up working with Jennifer Brozak and pitching one to Bade. And that's the one that got us a nomination for the Hugo. And then from there, I ended up selling five anthologies to Bade in a row. And then now I've sold to St. Martin's, to Titan, to a bunch of places. So it just kind of, I discovered I had a knack for it. And I got really damn lucky.
You know, I'm going to tell you what I appreciated was, you know, when this first came up and you found out how eager I was to be able to contribute something to the Predator universe. I get approached more than ever now about anthologies and people putting things together and stuff. And sometimes some people have a very good approach and sometimes people don't have a good approach. And sometimes I got one recently. Somebody's like, hey, yeah, we're doing an anthology for something, for some press, some small press, and we're looking for like 10 to 15,000 words. If you're welcome to submit, we can't guarantee anything, but if you want to submit, go for it. And I'm like, I have people who pay for my writing, you know, to do something where I'm getting this highly speculative whatever, where what you did, or you're like, all right, give us a pitch for what you want to do, okay? And then you as an editor, I think you have enough reputation, you can say, okay, I think this author's good. If this author's pitch is good, if they drop the ball, I'll tweak and help make sure that it kind of lands where it needs to be. And I think that's a great quality.
That's pretty much what I did. Because no offense to you, but Titan really didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
So Titan wasn't like, you know, oh, Andrew Main, awesome. They were kind of like, who's Andrew Main? So I said, trust me, he's successful. He's also a TV personality, which they absolutely go nuts for. They love that, okay? And I said, you know, he's a big fan of the franchise. We lost this other author who we thought we had. We need to fill the slot. This guy's enthusiastic. Let's give him a shot. So I said, you know, I can fix it if anything's wrong with the story. He's got a great idea. Fox signed off on the idea, so you were in.
Well, and I think that the help there was a fact that, and I was enthusiastic because it's funny because publishing sort of a big world and you have in some areas people like, oh yeah, we love this person, we like what they do, and you go to other ones and like, I'm not a guy who's been, I've been self-publishing sci-fi, but my domain's been thriller mysteries and stuff. And so, you know, for me, it was like, oh yeah, I'd love to go do this sort of thing. But it was, it is that kind of funny thing when you go into a different area where nobody knows who the hell you are, you know?
Yeah.
But working with somebody like you, it was great. And I thought that your way of handling this was better than I've seen other people who just are like, hey, just submit, go through the work. And then, you know, I don't know what'll happen, but where what you've done is, I think it's really great. And I think it's a strength of a really good editor. And putting together anthologies is hard. I mean, trying to get one author to deliver, to get dozens of authors, and you've got a fantastic lineup here, Jonathan Mayberry, Kevin J. Anderson, Larry Correa, you know, these are great, great, well-known authors, and to get everybody to be on board and send stuff in, that must speak well to your reputation. Or black
well,
material.
This is my 11th anthology, and I've got a 12th one coming out too. So, in fairness, I'm a professional and have experience, and I've learned from my mistakes. So let's just say that I have perfected my approach over the course of time.
Right.
So, what would one of those mistakes be?
Please help me to more of a professional approach. You know.
How did you find your way in as an editor and working in this capacity? How did that come about?
I like collaboration. I've always liked collaborating, and the term that I love, I got from interviewing Ted Danson for my college newspaper as an alumnus. Ted said, I'm a talent slut. I'm kind of a talent slut, man. If really cool people write really cool stories and I get to be the one to read them first, I kind of get off on that.
Right.
It's kind of fun, you know, especially when some of the authors are people that you're a big fan of. It's like, I'm getting to read a story first. Ah, you know, and you know, if I can help younger writers or lesser known writers in some way move into other genres or get their first sale, that's, I also really get excited about that. Help them move to the next level in their career. Because people help me get to the level that I'm at. I had a lot of people cheering me on. A lot of people vouched for me, and a lot of authors who were willing to work with me and take a chance on me as a new editor. So I'm kind of returning the favor. So a lot of that came from my love of collaboration and wanting to bring people together to work together. And I have a background in theater where my job at a theater camp was we wrote an original musical in 3 weeks every summer. And my job was to assemble the script from all the disparate parts of all the different ideas of all the 20, 30 students that were participating and help make a coherent show. So I basically, we called it Hill Street Blues Theater because my job was to assemble all the storylines and somehow make them connect in a way that flowed. So I'm really good at working with multiple people and multitasking that way. I think it lends itself to editing anthologies.
Well, so an anthology is comprised of a bunch of short stories. And I found it was kind of funny because I have people ask me like, hey, do you think short stories are a great way to get into novels? And my answer was, I have an easier time writing a novel than a short story. It's just the way I think. And ideally, if I was a more well-rounded author, I'd be able to do all of those things. But how do you feel a short story path as a way to get into novels, et cetera, larger formats?
Yeah, you know, you're number 5 best-selling UK Amazon author of the year. Yeah, you suck, man. You're awful. I'm telling you, it's just a talent that some people have and some don't. And
well, I mean, okay. I did spend all last month almost number 1 for the entire month, but that's not important. And make sure
all
the people
I'm trying to say, Andrew, is you don't have to go to therapy for this. You're okay. Okay. You know, the reality of it is I've always been better at long form too because that's what I read and grew up on. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people who grew up on short fiction are real huge short fiction fans and find it easier to write short fiction. I've only been writing successfully short fiction for the last year. I had to learn it. It took me editing 9 or 10 anthologies to really get to the point where I felt confident and could actually get a pro sale out of my short fiction. And most of those have been collaborations with people. And so, you know, it's not my strength as a writer, but I am good at editing them. And because I got good at editing them and I understood how they worked, I became able to write them. So there are a lot of writers Mike Resnick, who's one of the most prolific short story writers and one of the most award-winning in all of science fiction, started out as a novelist, didn't start writing, you know, till 25 years in, he started writing short stories finally. And now he writes a ton of short stories. But he was originally only writing novels because that's where the money was. So, you know, you're not alone in that. I think it does take it's a different kind of approach, and it is not one that is easily mastered by somebody who's mastered the other. You really have to adjust how you think about story. And in the same way, going from short story writing to novels can be a challenge.
What's the market like now? Because it used to seem like there was a much bigger market for short stories. It seems like it's not so much there anymore, even though I would think almost as to how easy it is to publish now that it would be.
Well, the science fiction and fantasy market is very strong.
Okay.
There's tons of short fiction options. Many of them now are online. But there's tons of professional paying markets for science fiction and fantasy, and even horror. But outside of that, there's only a few for mystery, and there's only a few for other things. It's just that the foundation of science fiction and fantasy, in part, has been so inspired by short fiction that we've kept it as a core value of our subgenres to a degree that we have maintained and continue to support the venues to keep them alive. And I don't think it always happens that way in other genres. So as a guy who's saying you haven't written a lot of sci-fi, you came from thrillers in a different genre. You may be saying, the thriller market doesn't have a lot of opportunities. The science fiction market does.
Yeah, I've self-published sci-fi. I've had a number of, sci-fi books that I self-published make it into the best-selling, sci-fi and stuff in the top 10 and stuff and get optioned and stuff.
I know because I've seen some of your books. I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
But you've concentrated more in other genres. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. And I'd say, but it's as a market. I don't know anything about it. I literally don't know anything about the formal professional market of that. It's been a passion for me. And I know that there's an avid reader base there. But yeah, I wouldn't have known where to begin or if I wrote a science fiction story or whatever to do. I had Orbital and Station Breaker, Tantor Audio came to me and said, let's do the audiobooks. But other than that, like the first commissioned piece of sci-fi I've done is with you. That's the first time because it's just, I talk a lot about writing. I have a lot of answers, but there are things I don't know anything about,
But would the reshifting of that market be in that, magazines used to be a place where a lot of short fiction was purchased and now that has kind of shifted? What has taken the place in science fiction and genre what used to be magazines and subscriptions and stuff like that?
If you look at, there's three big print magazines that are still around, okay? And there are two that are owned by Dell, which also has two big mystery magazines. These science fiction magazines, Analog and Asimov's, have circulations in like the 20,000 range, okay?
Okay.
The next best thing is about, I think it's about 15,000 circulation, so that's Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine. And then you get to the online market where circulations are much smaller, but access is much greater. So they probably get a lot more hits than they have people that actually buy the subscription. So I think what happened is that the viability of producing magazines, the cost of it, has changed. Also, I don't know if you've noticed this, Andrew lives in Los Angeles. I don't know where you guys live. I live in Ottawa, Kansas. There's like the only place here that there's a newsstand, I think, is the grocery store, and not much of a newsstand. There's not newsstands on the corner like there are in Los Angeles and New York and stuff. And so newsstands are not a big deal anymore like they used to be. So finding a place to sell these and get them in front of potential buyers has become less and less. Even as bookstores have died out, it's been really hard. So that's been really hard on the magazine market, and circulations have dropped and more people were seeking information online, and it's just more people want the ebook version. It's just there's all kinds of factors that come into it. But it is expensive to produce magazines and put them out there because you can't just print on demand with them usually. You have to print thousands of copies and have some idea of how many you need to put out there in the store and how many you're going to, send out to your subscribers and so on and so forth. And it's complicated, a lot of paper and whatever. So
it's certainly a market, and everything just changes so much because, I talk a bit about like what I did 6 years ago, but things have changed just dramatically since then. And then I talk to traditional publishers and it's like, they feel like sometimes they're 15 years behind or 20 years behind,
Absolutely. I'm curious if is there any parallel in magic to that, or is magic pretty much more steady and that I mean, I would assume Magic is a little steadier in some way.
I would definitely agree with the sentiment that Magic endeavors to exist in a steady state forever. In fact, the biggest rifts in Magic are, you know, when outside influences force change, and magicians are fairly resistant to it. They love the novelty of new, innovative ways to fool people. They're less thrilled about new, innovative ways to spread the secrets of their art.
I gotcha. Okay, well, I was thinking that, you know, I was wondering if there was any kind of comparison. I mean, everybody goes through change, but there are art forms that tend to be a little more resistant to it just by nature than others. But I know with magazines in particular, you know, magazine reading still as a general form is becoming more and more something people do. Less and less do we have, you know, 50 subscriptions in our house, and more do we just read them when we go to the doctor's office kind of thing. Or look for them online and don't want to pay to have them in our house.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of what's happened.
I would say that success in magic happens to people who innovate and change. And I think that the problem is that magicians who are trying to figure out why they're not getting traction are the ones that are trying to do things the way that they were done before, and that world has changed. If you're trying to if you're trying to go to Las Vegas to become a star like Siegfried and Roy did, it's not going to work the same. If you're trying to get a TV special like David Copperfield did to be famous, it's not going to work the way that did. And I would say that, you know, in this day and age that, you know, you get people who are trying to do YouTube as magicians on YouTube, and their product is indistinguishable from everybody else doing YouTube magic prank stuff, that's hard. And maybe you get a moment of a clip that gets a lot of traction, but that's not going to change itself into a stage show or whatever. And I think you have to look at, I'm biased because Brian's my buddy, but you have to look at somebody like Brian, who has this balance of like, hey, what makes a magician special and interesting? And so he's created multiple YouTube shows for this stuff and done television and does these things and built a sustainable enterprise. And I've been with Brian in public and people come up and recognize Brian because of, you know, the internet. But Brian isn't trying to do the same thing now that he was doing 5 years ago.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had an idea recently, and I'm going to save it to share with you guys off air, and then maybe in a future After Things episode, I'll pitch it to you.
Yeah,
just tease us and leave us hanging.
Sorry, that's exactly what's happening. No regrets, YOLO.
I found that, like, for me in promoting, like, 4 or 5 years ago, I probably should have done like a YouTube channel talking about writing, but for me, live streaming's been a great thing because people dip in and out, and I know that it's easier for people to skim and find you while you're live streaming. It's very easy to be discovered from there, whether you're here or face more easy on Twitter and Periscope, really, for me. But it's more
right,
easy.
But 5 years ago, you couldn't have done that. See,
yeah, there was Justin.tv and other ways to do it, but I think that my audience that reads books and stuff weren't there.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You couldn't have done it, not because they didn't have the technology, but because people weren't aware of it and looking for it and using it the way they are now.
Yeah.
It's you know, they wouldn't have found you as easily because now it's become a thing. So people will find you. So
yeah, you know, I would say that something we did 6 years ago was where I had Justin do audio versions of my books that we distributed on iTunes as podcasts. I think that would work even better today because Audible's become, but that was to print the push the ebooks. I would say we would do that now and push a really, you know, well edited together Audible book. And I could see that thing that worked before could even work even better now because of where people are in their consumption.
We push both. But it was home rolled audiobooks sold off our own site.
But you did a great job of that. I mean, I leveraged, you know, what did I have access to? I had somebody with a fantastic voice and said, okay, let me take advantage of that. And that was a way to reach a new audience. So, yeah, I think these things change so much. And, you know, I don't know what works. And I'm always curious to figure out because I, you know, where the markets are. But getting, getting stories out there, et cetera. And somebody points out in the discussion with Sigler, you know, it says, I think Scott Sigler is reigning in how many free audiobooks he puts out. True. But look at where Scott's doing on Audible, how well his paid audiobooks are doing.
Yeah.
Because
did you have Scott on the show?
I don't think Scott has been. We're all buddies with Scott, though.
I believe we always have Scott in our hearts, and that's yeah. That's the most important.
Yeah, where Scott looked at, we're doing the audiobooks as a freebie was a way to build audience, but now there's such a huge Audible audience that now it's like, oh, what makes Audible great is people get, if you're a subscriber, you get that automatic credit or a couple credits a month. So you're not trying to convince people to spend $5 or $15. They're spending that credit. And I think that, you know, I've watched how often Scott's Earth Core comes up as a recommended to me. So it means it's got to be doing really well. And that shift from, hey, I'll give this away for free just to pull people in here, like, oh, now we'll bring in an amazing narrator and produce this really well, is a really interesting shift.
I think also for Scott, what changed is that was the easiest way. Reading, serializing his books was the easiest way to bring an audience in to have a connection with him. And he's such a great personality that now he does a lot of other stuff. Like him and A will do podcasts breaking down, you know, the plots of movies and stuff like that. And really that idea of, okay, here's this connection with me and my brain and my mind that you enjoyed, but maybe you read too fast for the idea of, you know, something that's serialized. That was the idea that we had back when I was reading Andrew's books, was that we would serialize them as the podcast. But really, that was just the baseline. Like, hey, if you can deal with the torture of listening to 15 minutes of this story, which ratchets up very fast and keeps going very, very quickly over the course of 2 months, or once it's over, you know, a piecemeal through all these podcasts with all these ads, then fair enough. But we're going to bet that about halfway through, if not earlier, you're going to be like, oh, screw it. Here's my $2. I just want to read the rest of this now.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that was prior to Amazon having the ACX program, which made it very easy for indies to get stuff onto Amazon. And there's what that is that anybody can go with a book to Audible and say, hey, I want to make an Audible version of this. And you can either work out, you can find, submit, look for narrators and make a profit arrangement with them, or supply your own professionally produced tracks and do that. And that's been a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing.
I just had my first audiobook come out that way.
Oh, really? Which one's that?
Yeah, it's a WordFire anthology I did called Decision Points. It's a YA anthology. And it sold about 8,000 copies between paper and ebook, and now we have the audiobook version. And, you know, other than mispronouncing a couple people's names, the guy did a pretty good job.
Oh, that. It only matters if it's your name. And that's the cost of production on that is certainly higher than ebooks, but the getting it to that point is certainly...
And the important thing is that even if it's not a huge market or as big a market as we foresee it being, it certainly is a new market. You're able to reach people who quite simply don't dedicate, sit down, my eyes on these pages time. You know, there's unused bandwidth during, you know, dishes, chores, ferrying the kids all around and stuff, that all of a sudden you're able to get your books into a previously, you know, untappable market. But yes, it's more expensive, but it's worth it. Kind of like mining in space. Yes, it's more expensive, but you're tapping into something that's simply not available anywhere else.
Yeah,
it was actually. But the coolest part for me was that one of my original stories in my space opera Davi Re series was in there, and that's the first time I've had one of my original series done in audio. So I've had, you know, tie-in stories done in audio, my X-File story. I've never had something that was completely made up by me done in audio, and that was cool.
That's very cool.
That's awesome.
So it's kind of a nice experience to get that. And that was the first time that had ever happened. So, you know, that made it all the more exciting. How did it feel, Andrew, to hold an official Predator book in your hand and see your name in there?
I had to look to find my name because it wasn't on the cover. But other than that, it was great. And I didn't realize I could put in a page-length biography like everybody else did, but it was still really cool.
First of all, it wasn't my decision to include you the way you were included on the cover, but you are on the cover, and
you're inside the Predator armor.
Look,
that's where you are.
I gotta ask for more. It's always what I'm gonna do.
No. Look, it says it lists five authors, and it says and many more, and you are the and stands for Andrew.
Well, actually, look at the screen there. Look at who it says by.
It does.
Yeah. You need to tell your friends at Titan that Andrew has some Amazon mojo going on there.
It says here, yes, Predator, if it bleeds.
I know. I told them about that. That's amazing. I told them about that. And I said, get that son of a bitch's name out from being listed in front of mine because I'm the editor. And they said, who is he? No, I'm kidding.
Brian Thomas, I am very grateful, very, 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 very grateful for the opportunity to be there, and it has been an absolute highlight for me.
You did a great job. And the fans, more importantly, the fans loved the book, and they thought your story was one of the highlights. So, more importantly, we have succeeded. That's what matters.
Yeah, I'm. Listen, anything else you can sign me up for? Let me know.
Well, I'm working on a couple of things, so we'll see what happens. I got meetings in New York all next week, so I'm going to New York Comic Con, and then I'll be doing meetings, so we'll see what happens.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
The Home Alone anthology. Finally, Andrew can get all of his Kevin McAllister fan fiction out there.
Oh, because other kids get left home alone. Home Alone on Halloween. Let's do it with a twist.
I'm there. I'm all for that. So my pick is The Predator anthology, If It Bleeds. It is a thrill to be in here. I am so thankful for Brian for doing this, for Peter J. Wax for making me aware of this, and I cannot wait to dig into this because it's like to see my name next to like some of my favorite authors is just absolutely wonderful, 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 wonderful. So I'm super, super stoked about that. You know, I'm bummed that I didn't get to do like my crazy pick was I wanted to do. I tell you about my. We have one idea that maybe might make it into another anthology, but the craziest one I want to do, I don't think they'll ever let me do, is I wanted to do a Predator Sherlock Holmes crossover.
Ha! You know what's funny about that? That right now, Sherlock Holmes is in the public domain, so you totally could do that. Second of all, Titan publishes a whole series of Sherlock Holmes novels, like new novels all the time. And there's the Mycroft Holmes series written by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That are also a series with Titan. So, you know, it's not out of the range of possibility that Titan would go for that. I doubt Fox would.
Yeah. Wah, wah. I just think that, like, the idea of Sherlock Holmes finding out why all these big game hunters in England have been killed in weird, mysterious ways would be such an interesting story.
And at the end,
spoiler, it's the Predator.
He sits down and shares a pipe with the Predator and they laugh.
Exactly.
My pick is The Pilot, the story written by Andrew Main in Predator If It Bleeds, available right now.
That's right. He didn't get to do his first choice, I will say that. He pitched a story, unfortunately, that somebody else had pitched one a little too similar to. And so I had to make him do a second choice story. And I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it goes sometimes.
Hey, it was your loss, man. It was your loss.
It just so happens that a New York Times bestselling author who commands $250,000 advances on his books wanted to do the similar story, and so
I'm working on it.
Look, I apologize. We're all friends here, but I'm afraid I'm gonna have to call out what you guys are doing. Both of you guys are just pandering to our guests here by picking the Predator stuff. My pick is pure and honest. My pick is The Naturalist, now available in paperback, available at Amazon.com by Andrew Main.
Which did not a New York Times best-selling book. But it did spend most of last month at number one on Amazon. So.
Are you just going to keep picking different books or what? Or are you each picking a book?
We're all picking you.
This is a segment of the show where everyone picks something.
Yeah, normally we actually curate stuff, but in this case, we're just too giddy with the level of talent and success that we're surrounded by.
Okay, I just didn't know there was going to be so much picking going on this show. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm super, super. I'm as an author, I feel so very fortunate to have two releases this month. To have The Naturalist and be part of The Predator. You know, that is it's exciting. Well, and I'm very.
I mean, you know, well, the reason I asked you how you felt about being on it was part of the reason I do it is because of that. Honestly, part of the reason I do anthologies is because I love when my authors feel good and excited about being in an anthology. That's oh, absolutely. Part of the reason. See, that's like me. I don't know if you know the there's a whole thing called love languages, but one of my love languages with my friends and family is to give stuff to people. And mm-hmm. I'm telling you, it's really nice. The joy comes from watching them get the gift and appreciate it. So yeah. That's a big part of what motivates me as an editor is seeing my authors go, "Squee, I get to be in the book." I mean, it's just really, it makes you feel really good.
It's absolutely. And it's funny too, because it's like, it's the connection I have to people who worked in the Predator franchise is fun. One of our friends, Larry Fong, is the director of cinematography for the new movie, and there's some other stuff going on there. But that was just, it was kind of cool to be like, oh yeah, by the way, I get to do this thing, you know?
Right. You have mutual friends who know Shane Black as well, besides yep. Larry, right? Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And I met yeah. Shane years ago. I've read the script and the
yeah, sorry, Shane Black wrote the original Predator story. Now he's directing and writing the new Predator movie. Just sorry to interrupt you.
He didn't write the original Predator story. That was Larry and John Thomas.
He didn't do a rewrite on it? Oh, wow.
He was brought. I don't know if he did or didn't. They've never said that. But the documentary that I watched, he was the reason they hired him to play a character. He was an actor in the original Predator.
And right.
The reason they hired him for that is they wanted a script doctor on set who could fix things if they needed it. Ironically, the original screenwriters who created it were also on set at the same time. So I'm not sure exactly what they were saying to them, but he's never said that he actually wrote anything or not. So I don't know if he did or didn't. You can be sure that there was some improvising and changing going on.
Yeah, no, that's a great
point. Always is on every movie. So certainly he contributed a line here or there. But whether he actually did an official draft, I don't know.
No, it's a very good point. Very good point. Thank you for correcting me on that.
Well, you're talking to a guy who had to become a kind of a bit of an expert on Predator to do this book. So I've watched everything I can find. I've read everything I can find. So that's my best recollection of the history. But, you know, there are all the time secret drafts that go on that people can't take credit for. So you never know.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been kind of an open secret that Shane contributed heavily to it, to what degree that he was. And part of the reason I've heard the rationale that why he was on set was so that he could be doing rewrites. And that gets into be a very, very sticky thing, too, because often when you have a franchise like that, you know, when you get a powerful, powerful, powerful director like was it McTiernan, is that, you know, they tend to want to have somebody there to sort of do what they want to as far as writing and changing things. I've just been watching a lot of the behind the scenes for Blade Runner, you know.
Right. But what's interesting is that McTiernan really didn't have a whole lot of films under his belt when he did this. This was kind of his first big blockbuster thing. I can't remember if he came out of music videos or what, but I was watching the documentary. This was kind of it was early in his career, too. So, yeah, they did have Joel Silver in particular, who certainly was a power broker at that point as a producer,
yeah.
Definitely wanted Shane Black on set as a writer. But, you know, like I said, in all the interviews with Jim and John Thomas, who yeah. created Predator and wrote the original script for that and Predator 2, and with Shane Black, I've never heard him admit to writing anything, and I've never yeah. heard anybody else actually say Shane Black rewrote his stuff.
Brian, thank you for coming in here and sharing this with us. I hope you come back again, and you know, we love hearing more about the inside of the writing and the editing practice. You know, you've done an amazing work before and continue to do that sort of stuff. So it's been absolute pleasure. So everybody check out Predator If It Bleeds, and I think you'll be delighted.
It comes out October 17th.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.